This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Getting off that hamster wheel of life, looking around, people suddenly realize, I don't know, maybe I've been working a job for the last 15 years that doesn't fulfill me, that I'm not happy with, or my partner's not doing it for me. They, you know, you've never stopped and look around and got off and the, you know, that hamster wheel. And we've had people leave their partners, and we've had people leave their jobs. Well, we've had obese people who are now marathon runners. We've had big, quite seismic changes. I don't position it as a transformational travel experience, and I don't really want to attract people who are maybe in the midst of a midlife crisis too much. But it is beneficial for people, partly through the adversity and partly just through slowing down, I think.
That is a clip from today's guest, Tom Williams, talking about the inadvertent transformative nature of the trips he runs for his company, Desert Island Survival, where he can take you to a deserted island, experts teach you survival skills, then they leave you stranded there to survive for 3 days. You can check it out at DesertIslandSurvival.com as an accompaniment to this interview if you want to read up on what he does. And today you'll hear Tom discuss some of his own transformative travel experiences, how he went from working as an international wealth manager to taking people to desert islands to survive, how moving to Honduras for 7 months helped him overcome childhood bullies and other challenges back home in England, the other huge travel decision he made that created radical change in his life and how it still impacts him today, why your perception of destinations changes so much over time, some of his top lessons for running a business remotely, how he tested his idea for this company before putting a lot of money into it, and what lessons you can take from that to do the same, how he finds deserted islands in the modern world, and much more. Plus, I'm going to give a shout out to a Windshield Time listener who has fulfilled the travel dream she's been working towards for 7 years. Got to give her some props here. And why this Grammy award-winning multimillionaire artist who I love makes a strong case for making your life and work more complicated. All of that and much more is happening right now in today's show. So buckle up. Strap in. Thanks for being here. And welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, what's up? It's Jason here with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show, my friend. Thanks for hanging out here today, letting me bring a little travel into your ears. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. Now, relax, grab a beverage, and just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip. Okay, that's a very old school reference. The theme song to Gilligan's Island, where a bunch of people get shipwrecked and stranded on a desert island, I guess for 3 years, because that's how long the show was on the air. And I had a funny fact to share. Have you heard of this show? I mean, I know this was even before my time, and I ain't no spring chicken, but this was a pretty kind of quirky, funny show. Did you know Gilligan, the goofball on the show, had a first name? Gilligan's first name is Willie, according to the internet. Willie Gilligan. Anyway, there's a fun fact to kick this show off. And on a serious note, a lot coming out of this conversation with Tom about what led him to begin leading trips to deserted islands, teaching people survival skills, and then leaving them there to survive, and the journey that his life took to kind of get to this point, and why this is resonating so much right now with people in this modern age, wanting to kind of get back to those survival basics. This was really intriguing to me, and you heard, if you listened to the show regularly last week, we had a guest on who was sharing his experience going on one of these trips. And as soon as I heard that and kind of discovered what Tom did, I thought, I got to have him on the show. I want to find out how and why this guy started a company like this, why it's resonating, and this idea of transformative travel, although that was not his intention, with this was to create some kind of transformation in people. Going through an experience like this is doing that. Isn't that what travel kind of does to us inadvertently, right? It's like almost like a byproduct of travel. We can't help but be changed. And in this interview, Tom shares a couple personal travel experiences that really changed him. Of course, as you go about listening to this, I encourage you to reflect on some of your past travels and how they may have transformed you and how they may continue to impact you today. And if you want to use that as a prompt to get in touch, please reach out. If you're a listener to the show and you haven't said hi yet, drop me a line. jason@zerototravel.com is my email. Read all those emails from listeners, or better yet, drop me a voicemail in the voicemail box that I have set up in each and every show notes. You can just click on a link and leave a voicemail. Easy peasy. Of course, sign up at zerototravel.com if you want to hop on the newsletter list and stay in touch off the podcast. Now, before we dive in to the interview segment, I do want to give a shout out to somebody in this listening community. This story inspired me. They've been working for 7 years towards a travel goal. And speaking of the transformative nature of travel, this reminded me of something that I think is important for all of us travelers to remember when we're not traveling, when we're perhaps working towards a travel goal. Now, here's that listener voicemail.
Hey, Jason, it's Steph here. I am a longtime loyal fan, follower, and subscriber of the podcast. I did the math the other day, and I've been listening to your podcast since 2015, which is just crazy. And I listened to it like religiously on my drive every day to and from my old corporate job and then to and from college. And it just really shaped the way I viewed the world and really helped ignite the fire in my soul for my travel dreams. So I wanted to come in here and give you the biggest thank you ever and give you the exciting news. My partner and I are tuning in right now from Bangkok, Thailand. We have finally, after over 7 years of dreaming and planning about this, we've embarked on our own nomadic journey. We're traveling all around Asia right now and then gonna head over to Europe next year. But we wanted to say thank you. I don't know if this would be possible if it wasn't for your podcast, because I mean, you've just been such a source of inspiration for this trip. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you very much, Steph, and huge congratulations. I love what you said about igniting the fire in your soul. I love that phrase, ignite the fire in my soul. And 7 years of planning is no small thing. And this is what stuck out and reminded me. That's transformative as well. That time before you travel where you're working towards a goal, it really is a trip before the trip. And I need to remind myself of this sometimes as I work towards the next things, as we all do in life, right? We're kind of got our next thing coming up. And sometimes it's easy to just focus on the destination and see, oh, once I get there, things are going to be so great. But we have to remember to take the lessons from the lead up to it, which isn't just a lead up to the thing. It's our life, right? It's just a reminder for me, and I wanted to share some thoughts around that for you, and also just quickly acknowledge what Steph and Dalt, her partner, have accomplished working towards this travel goal, now living that nomadic lifestyle they've been working towards. So congrats to them. By the way, they just launched a podcast called Life with Steph and Dalt. If you want to check that out, happy to just give them a quick plug and support another podcaster, because that's a lot of work to get a podcast out there. So congrats to them on that as well. Now, let's get into the interview segment of today's show. And you heard what's coming. I don't need to preface it anymore. I really loved this conversation with Tom Williams. And I do encourage you to check out desertislandsurvival.com if you want to see what he's up to there. I'm on the email list over there. And I really like this idea. It's such a unique travel experience. And if you ever wanted to be a castaway on a desert island, I mean, who hasn't? Then you can check them out and stick around on the back end. Of course, I'll leave you with a quote. And I do want to share a lesson I just pulled out from a Grammy winning multimillionaire artist who I really love, who makes a strong case for making things more complicated than they need to be. Why would you do that? Maybe that'll be part of the challenge I leave you with today, the listener challenge. There's a little hint. I'll get into that on the back end. Stick around for some commentary on the interview as well. And I hope to see you there. Enjoy this chat, and I'll see you on the other side, my friend. What trip are you recently back from?
Just got back from Panama.
Panama. Nice.
Yeah.
A Central American country I haven't been to. Give me your sort of your impressions of Panama as a place to travel, to visit.
It's beautiful wilderness, lovely tropical jungle, and obviously being on the being that isthmus, that thin bit of land, you've got Pacific and Caribbean on both sides, so you've got that variety. But Panama City is not much to look at. It's got a kind of gritty. It's not my first choice of country in Central America, but we look for unique situations for specific countries to have everything we need for our islands, and Panama has it in spades over on the Pacific coast.
Yeah, cool. Should really quickly welcome you to the show. I'm with Tom Williams from DesertIslandSurvival.com. We're going to talk all about survival and how you got into this, and I'm so excited. I've been waiting for this one because I'm just excited to hear your story and how this all started for you. Where are you right now? Are you back home, or where is home, by the way?
Well, home is, we've been very much nomadic as a family. I'm in Lisbon. I just moved to Lisbon 8 days ago, and it's been frantic because the whole world seems to be moving here. And so it's like, it's a bum fight to get any accommodation. And so, yeah, we just got a confirmation on an apartment. We're moving in on Thursday. I'm bouncing around Airbnbs with my family right now. But no, I spent the last 10 years in Chile, and then I've been on the road living in Thailand, in Mexico, in Spain, and now Portugal. But Portugal is forever home, or at least for the next like 5-10 years, we'll see.
Okay, yeah. Why did you choose Portugal to be home?
So we wanted to be back in Europe. We're ready for a bit of that European stability. I've got a 5-year-old son, and we want him to be close to his grandparents. We want good schools and all that stuff. But we couldn't possibly live in England. The weather is just untenable. And we are, there's a lot of, like, the people here are lovely. Like, Lisbon, it's this functional city, but it feels like 1,000 villages stitched together. It's this default kind of kindness. It doesn't feel too, it has boutique stores rather than chain stores. It just feels, still feels cool. And kind, like it's a kind city. And so, yeah. And there's a few tax benefits for living in Portugal that have just come about as well. It's pretty liberal leaning. It's got beautiful wilderness, great. I like kite surfing. It's got good kite surfing. Yeah. It just seems to tick a lot of boxes. I'm 8 days into living here, but so far loving it.
Awesome. That's a good, pretty good coffee too, I'd say, if you're a coffee drinker. Well, maybe you're more tea, you know, the English,
I've got my tea right here.
They like their tea. I know you like your tea. I might have to harass you a bit more about Portugal because I have two kids, and I was thinking the other day, maybe I'll take my son down to the coast of Portugal for a little scouting trip as a potential, you know, because we live in Norway, so need kind of a place to get away from the cold, dark, long winter, as you know very 100%. Well, coming from England, right?
100%. Well, me casa is too casa, mate. We've just got a nice big spare bedroom. So, and how old are your kids?
Well, I have a 6-year-old daughter, and my son will turn 4 pretty soon.
Perfect. So one either side of my son Edward, who's 5. So, yeah, come on, man.
So you
come
have
and
one,
stay.
One child.
Yeah, one and done.
Cool, yeah. He's, we're always looking for additional playmates. So, and I went so far as to sort of like cross-reference international school locations with surfing places that had a good beginner break because I'm crap when it comes to surfing, but I like to get out and do it. So I don't know. We'll see. That's another tangent. I did want to talk a bit about your growing up. Do you have any siblings yourself?
No, I'm an only child. Hopefully not a classic only child, but I am.
And you grew up in England.
Yeah.
Was it a small village type place or a city? Where did you?
It was an island, but it's an island that you wouldn't even know it was an island. Okay. It's called Portsmouth, and it's got a causeway that attaches it. But it's a very densely populated island on the south coast of England, overlooking the Isle of Wight. It's there's worse places to grow up. There's better places to grow up. But yeah, it was tumultuous.
In what way?
I don't know. I feel like I'm so fortunate to be where I am today. There are so many crossroads in life. I was the fattest kid in my school. I came bottom of the year of my school. It was not looking good. My nickname was Bum. And somehow I've navigated out of this path of being this guy in Portsmouth to, living somewhat a dreamy life, taking people to desert islands. So, it's still pinching myself, really, that I escaped.
Really? Yeah. Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind. You know, especially at those ages when you get sort of labeled as something or you get put into a box in some way and you don't have the mature brain to kind of understand that that's just something that externally people are putting on you and it's not really your own definition of yourself, right? Which is what matters most. But how did you kind of break out of that? In some ways,
it's literally like I prepped you with that. You took the words out of my life. It's all about labels and words out of my mouth. And so when I was always had these labels on me, I was, you know, thick, fat, what a stupid bummer. And then I went and mapped coral reefs in Honduras randomly when I was 20 years old. I managed to get this to count it as a year of university. I guess I was coming out of this fairly negative period of life, maybe as it was, but once I finally left, you know, the surroundings of my peer groups and stuff, who are still some of my best friends today, and went and lived in Honduras and suddenly became the guy within this coral mapping community who had been there the longest, who people looked up to, who, you know, had to learn every single species of fish, coral, invertebrate within the Caribbean Sea, and I was a dive master and all this stuff. And that finally, I was treated differently and I came back suddenly with my head held higher and realized, wait a minute, I was just labeled these things. I'm not necessarily these things. And so like, if my son was in that kind of position, I think like a radical tangent moving to somewhere completely different where you don't have those labels around you, where you don't have that kind of that box surrounding you can be really beneficial and really, really allow you to shake them off. And I think, you know, wilderness therapy is used in that way with like teenage children from inner cities. Problem backgrounds. Some of my instructors who run our classes, they also do wilderness therapy with teenagers, and they have amazing success by taking people out of that environment and just, you know, showing them kindness, showing them different values and such. So yeah,
one of the other many benefits of travel, I guess you could say, right? It's almost tragic that it needs to be so extreme, right? Like you need to actually fly away from where you live and everybody you know, just to, not you, but I mean, just in general, like I understand that whole situation where like sometimes it just takes getting around something new and a new place to just kind of reinvent some part of it. Is it really a reinvention if it's already there? You know, it's just like you're in a situation where people are just, it's kind of tough.
It's like repotting a plant.
Right. So that really opened things up for you. And how long were you in Honduras? How long did you live there?
For 7 months. I'd scraped my way to university and I was staying with this guy called Simon who said, I'm going to Fiji to map coral. And I was like, that sounds incredible. I'm coming too. And he's like, no, mate, you're not coming to Fiji as well. This is my thing. I was like, fair enough. He's like, but this company called Coral K Conservation, I don't know if they're still going. They probably are. They had programs in the Philippines and in Honduras. And so I was like, right, I'll do the Honduras one. And so I went and did that. And it counted as a year of university, college, from kind of scraping past in year one and year two with like base level pass marks of 40%, 41%. My final year, which luckily counted for 75% of my whole degree, I was writing about something I was newly passionate about, the effects of scuba tourism on coral. And I was so lit up by what I was doing that I found passion in learning for the first time as well. So that was a big part of it. And I got like 86% in my final year. So from getting like bottom marks for 15 years of education, I finally got like really good qualification at that last year and ended up with a 2-1. So yeah, it was really cool that it counted as a year of university.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I feel that the education system is outdated, right? Like sometimes it's just a matter of giving people an opportunity to just find out what lights them up. Right?
100%. You know, the classic adage of judging a fish by how well it climbs a tree. You know, I came bottom of my school. I've since learned that I'm not complete idiots. And you know, we don't measure metrics like, whatever it may be, like emotional intelligence or social skills or things like that. We just literally, traditionally, judge how well you can retain information, regurgitate it, and forget it the next day. And that's a ridiculous way of learning, and it is changing, but you know, that's how it traditionally has been for so long. And also this kind of conformist side of it, of like, you will wear this outfit and you will adhere to this bell when it goes off, and kind of almost like this Victorian pre-industrial or the industrial time for getting us used to going to the factory and to clocking in and clocking out and obedience and such. And so, yeah, it's changing, but definitely like education is, it was broken for a long time. It still probably is in many ways.
Yeah. How does your experience with all this growing up impact your parenting now?
I'm really lucky that, well, my son, I think he seems to be the kind of kid who's going to get on very well in the traditional education system as it is. I don't know. I give him a lot more. I don't expect him to necessarily go to university. I want to certainly promote entrepreneurialism within him. I want him to look at like starting businesses, maybe from like age, I don't know, 12, 14, and start thinking about these things. When he turns 16, he has to survive on a desert island for 1 week with just a machete, by the way. He has that rite of passage. And that takes me on to another thing. Like you see within tribes, most tribes have some kind of rite of passage for when, you know, you become a man, you grow up, be it like wrestling in Mongolia or running on the back of cattle in Ethiopia or wearing a woven glove and getting stung by bullet ants in Amazon tribes. But like we see so much problem, like we've got so much energy in these teenage years and it kind of gets misspent and misdirected. And I think we need something like we're kind of almost ready for battle. We're so charged and it kind of, that energy gets pushed in the wrong direction. So like more coming of age in the Western world stuff would be cool in my opinion.
Yeah. I feel like what you're describing is really the crossroads of what you do, right? It's sort of like this primal thing, I don't know, with modern day, right? And there is like this, well, I mean, the company's been wildly popular, it seems. You already have their next couple years filled out on the trips. Yeah. So we're gonna get into that, but I want to pick your brain on just some like survival tips and things like that. But this is in demand, obviously, right? So there still is this, I don't think it's just you have to tell me because they're your clients, but my hunch is that it's not just that people want to learn survival skills because they think it's an important thing to know in life. It's more about the emotional kind of let's get back to sort of these basic, some of the primal needs or desires and get away from some of this stuff that's a very unnatural fit that's only come about over the last, you could say, decade even in some cases, you know, with smartphones and everything. Yeah. Is that fair to say?
Completely. It's hard to kind of put the finger on the one thing that people are looking for. I to kind of really stereotype my customer there, you know, maybe it's someone in their 30s who's working, about 70% tend to be male, but they're working a job that they don't particularly feel fulfilled by. They feel like something's missing. They just want to feel alive. They want more adventure. They want to kind of disconnect. And so, and this is just like one kind of avenue of where people may come from, but they want to do something completely different that allows them to completely step off the hamster wheel of life. And you know, we're so hyper connected, we're so stimulated, and we're so disconnected from nature, which has been, you know, it's hardwired into us, really. We always lived as tribes up until the dawn of agriculture 10,000 years ago. You know, we always lived immersed in nature. And this is our hardwiring. This is our programming. We haven't shaken that programming off at all yet. You know, we're still so young as a species. And so, yeah, when we go out and we spend time in nature and when we live as a tribe and in these communities, we just feel, it feels so right. We feel lit up. We feel kind of complete. And even though like our trips have, you know, a bit of adversity and challenge within them, people feel like they've truly had a holiday, a vacation. They've really actually managed to unwind and relax. And I do as well. Like I just got back from 3 trips back to back in Panama. And I can already feel like I'm tightening up again, like just by being in the city. On the island, I'm able to, I don't know, I can slip into a nap. I can manage to read my book without thinking about something else for an hour. towards the end of the trip when the customers are in their survival phase, that is. It's nourishing. It's really nourishing, that immersion in nature and living as a community with people.
We'll be back right after this. This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off-the-beaten-path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Let's get back to the show. You were working as an international wealth manager for 10 years.
I know.
If I just grab a snippet of something you said, I provide my clients with bespoke financial solutions and investment portfolios to suit their personal needs and objectives. How do you go from that to taking people to desert islands? Because that seems on the surface like a pretty big gap to bridge. How did that happen?
100%. So let's jump back a little bit. So, okay, did the Honduras thing. Then I went and worked as a dive master for a bit, snowboard instructor for a bit. And then the expectations of my parents were get a proper job, you know, get that traditional job. So I got a job selling software for an American software company. And I got depressed. I remember driving on the road thinking I could just crash my car into the central reservation and be done with it, you know, or not be done with it, but get a nice 3-week break in hospital or something like that. I was like, wait a minute, this is a suicidal tendency. This is not, you're not comfortable in this position. So my random kick out from that was I was speaking to my mate Paul in the pub, as you do, and he was like, I'm walking to the North Pole. And I said, all right, can I come? And he's like, yeah, man, let's walk to the North Pole. So I ended up signing up to the walks to the North Pole. That was in 2008. We trained for 2 years. And in 2010, I walked to the North Pole. And that was my way of being like, I'm not going to be labeled as a software salesman in London. And did that, and we won the race, and that's a whole other story.
What's the story? Tell us a little bit of the story.
It's hard.
What's it like to walk to the North Pole? I mean, come on.
It's the highest highs and the lowest lows. Like it's like being a child in the way that like everything is either amazing or terrible. Your emotions are so strained. It didn't get dark because it was spring. So the sun would just lap around the sky and you'd get like a 6-hour sunset that you'd walk into, which was cool. But it meant we didn't have to work on a 24-hour clock. So we'd work on like a 32-hour clock to walk by. And we'd walk for 2 hours, stop for 5 minutes, 2 hours, 5 minutes, 2 hours, 5 minutes. And then we would set up our camp, sleep for 4 hours and repeat. And we conditioned ourselves with our trainer to only, you know, the mind always gives up before the body. We always, if you're doing an exercise, you go, oh, this hurts, I can't do it. But if you were hanging from a tree and certain death awaited, if you let go of that tree, you know, you'd hold on until your last finger slipped and you fell. And that's how we kind of started to approach everything. And to the point where we actually fell asleep walking. I did twice, just fell into the snow. Like we got to that point where actually the body kind of gives up. What I guess that did for me was, well, one, it gave me a new label. I was like, right, I am worthy of setting up a survival business because I've walked to the North Pole. But that's just mindset, you know. It's just what I told myself, but it's not the case. And it gave me an ability to deal with adversity. Like I think when you leave your comfort zone so far out and then come back in, and then you oscillate within this kind of more easy area, everything else feels kind of attainable and easier to deal with to an extent. We ended up walking the last 50 hours without sleeping. We won the race by 2.5 days and we missed the world record by 2 hours. But it was a cool experience. It was getting to the start line was the hard bit. Like 2 years of training, fundraising was working this job. And the actual race almost felt like, you know, the cherry on top of the experience, but in a way. So I did that. And then in 2010, after walking to the North Pole, I moved to Chile because my wife got a job there with Diageo, the booze company. And then I managed to, whole other story, but I managed to blag myself into a super yacht that I saw in Panama and took a photo of. And I worked on a super yacht for 3 months. And then, and so I had this like real like vintage year in 2010 where I did all those things. And then I ran out of money and lived in Chile and I didn't speak Spanish. And so there's this kind of group of expats who are doing this finance stuff. And I was like, okay, well, I don't need to speak Spanish and I can do this and they're offering me a job. I'll do it. And so I just fell into this finance job that I just was not lit up by, but it was 100% commission. So I could have a sliding scale between time and money. And for me, time is more valuable than money. And it allowed me to pursue other things at the same time. So it gave me a kind of safety net whilst building Desert Island Survival. It took way too long, but it allowed me, you know, I don't think many people are courageous enough to just jump into setting up a business without having some kind of financial safety net. And it allowed me to kind of have the two concurrently whilst, you know, I didn't know that Desert Island Survival would work out.
Wow. So in hindsight, I think those two things stick out. I mean, you mentioned them, the Honduras trip and then the polar expedition was really kind of a one decision that was the domino, maybe you could call it the first domino, a bit of a one decision inflection point where there was radical sort of change afterwards in many ways. The desert island survival idea, I mean, you had experience walking in the North Pole, which is a freezing cold climate, surviving there. But when did the idea for the desert island survival come up? Because at some point, when you were doing this commission-based job, you had to kind of settle on an idea to pursue, right?
Yeah.
So what was the genesis of that?
Yeah, it's, you know, that childhood dream of always being marooned on a desert island was certainly part of it that some people have. But also, you know, with the coral side of things, I've always been looking to go diving in remote places. And I'm always looking to, like, over the edge of the map, like where is untouched by humanity and where can I see. I've always had that fantasy of jungle straight down to beaches that are untouched and seeing that. And I just looked online to see what was available to go and do these survival experiences. I found a couple of companies and I went on their trips and I was like, you know, this is all right, but it falls a little short of my expectations. One was a little bit militant, and kind of lacked the soft skills. He was ex-army. And it didn't have much of the purest bushcraft aspects that I wanted. And then the other one wasn't actually a remote island. It was a populated island in the Virgin Islands. And I was like, I want to be disconnected and I want to be learning primitive skills from like, you know, the best bushcraft people out there. And so I kind of blended those two things into a concept that I thought would be cool myself.
And when did that officially start? When did you run your first?
So I set up the company in 2016 and then early 2017, I actually went to recce the islands that I found, first island I found in Panama with the guy I walked to the North Pole with. I was meant to go with the Dutch guy, but he broke his leg 2 months before. And my mate Rupert, who I did the North Pole with, stepped in and we stayed out on the island. And then 3 months after that, I put a note out on my Facebook saying, I'm setting up this company. Who wants to come on the first trip and give me feedback? We'll just do this at cost price. And so I got four friends and then four friends of friends, which kind of worked out well because I'd never met these guys. So we didn't have that kind of relationship there. And they were just so lit up. They were like, this is awesome. You've got something here, man. This is really, really cool. And we thrashed out like how we could improve it, refine it. And then I was lucky enough to do this trip in the Virgin Islands I was mentioning with this guy called Tom McElroy, who is literally one of the best bushcraft people in the world. So when you watch Bear Grylls or Ed Stafford, he's one of the guys behind the camera handing the right wood for Bear Grylls to rub together. He's like bushcraft advisor. You can watch his stuff on YouTube. He's immense. And so I was like, hey, Tom, would you be interested in running these trips with me? Because bushcraft is one of these things, like it's a rule of 10,000 hours plus. You know, you can't just fake it. I know about marine ecology and stuff like this, but hey, I was not a bushcraft guy. I only started bushcrafts 7 years ago, and I'm still 6,000 hours into my journey. Whereas Tom and my other instructor, Lucas Miller, who you may know from season one of Alone, if you've ever watched that show. They're like 20, 30, 40, 50 thousand hours into their bushcraft journey. And maybe people can't notice that unless they're a connoisseur. Like, it's a difference between a nice bottle of wine and a vintage bottle of wine. But anyone who knows bushcraft, you can see this very stark difference of how I do a hand draw fire and how these guys do a hand draw fire. And I'm still absolutely learning from them. But spending time on islands with these, masters of bushcraft has been incredible for me. And I'm ranting a little bit, but the thing that I feel is what sets our trips apart and what makes them special is like the non-negotiables for me of the trip is that the island has to be perfect, and I have a whole checklist of what makes an island perfect that maybe we can go into. It has to be beautiful and safe and such, but also the instructors have to be really, really talented at bushcraft, but also emotionally intelligent enough to be able to read a group and to make it a fun experience. And so when you combine just these beautiful environments with really inspiring people, like that's the cake. And everything else that we do is kind of just the icing and the cherry and the fudge on top. But if you just, those two elements done really, really well, I think is what makes our trips really special and like why people say it's the best holiday of their lives.
Hmm. I think you shared a couple pretty powerful business lessons as well for the aspiring nomads or business owners out there. How you started it was just, hey, let me put this out here and get some friends and friends of friends. And if there's enough people interested, we'll go on this thing and see how they like it. And like you said, just do it at cost, which was really sounds to me like the perfect way to have your sort of minimum viable product. When it comes to this business, I think it's really easy to kind of get caught up in, I'm going to set up the website and then I have to, market it and all this stuff. It's like, no, maybe you just kind of find the easiest, lowest barrier of way to kind of test an idea. And then bringing in some experts that can help you out for the things you don't know, right? When you're actually ready to do it. And those two pieces, you're kind of off and running, and obviously a lot else involved in terms of the logistics and things like that. But just from the core sort of, hey, how do I start something really cool that I'm passionate about? I think those were a couple great lessons in there that you shared.
Thank you. And I think we never really had to make too much of an outlay financially to set this up. Like, it was a few thousand dollars here or there. And then never really had too much fixed outgoings as well. So when COVID came around and we had to basically mothball for 2 years, we ended up we went really hard on working on our CRM system and redoing the back end piece. But, we had little financial exposure. So we could quite literally survive as a survival company, which is important. And I've never tried to grow quickly, and we're still, we're full, but I'm so picky about islands that I'm not going to lower the bar and work with islands that don't meet my criteria. I'd rather just us. This isn't about making lots of money. This is about pursuing a passion and providing something really nourishing and beautiful for people. But I think growing slowly and organically, it's like a hardwood tree that's slower, slow and steady, kind of winning the race and not trying to rush it and force it. That organic growth works.
Yeah, and then of course, in some ways, it almost increases the demand, right? It's like, well, there's only so much.
Yeah, I'm hoping actually, that we're gonna. Well, we just sold out, and now we're moving to more of a waiting list model. So rather than having to be heavily remarketing and stuff, we can now just not really market too much and just have that waiting list. And as soon as dates come available, it's like go, and then maybe we'll even get to a kind of questionnaire of we've got 120 places a year, tell us why you should be marooned on a desert island company. It'd be nice to flip it around like that if we can.
Full transparency, I just signed up for the waiting list, Tom.
So this week we go out on the third biggest travel YouTube channel out there called Cara and Nate.
Yes, they've been on the show.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I can't believe I didn't know that. I'd love to. I'm going to go back and listen to that after this. They're lovely, lovely guys, and I'm not just blowing smoke up them, but they really genuinely warm, kind people and no ego despite their huge success. And yeah, they just crushed it on the island. They were amazing, really purist. And so, yeah, they got 3 million subscribers and excited to see how much this blows up. Just their Instagram post about us sold us out. So,
yeah, that'll be great for you guys. Just keep me at the top of that list. You know, I know you can shuffle it around in the back end there. No, I'm kidding.
Let's do it, man. Let's do it.
Why is learning survival skills like this important for the average person? Is it important?
You know, I don't think necessarily the learning primitive survival skills is, you know, it's certainly not something we're going to necessarily use in anger. But I think what I like is the appreciation for kind of layer zero of technology and going back to level one of Maslow's hierarchy. You know, if you've ever heard the blog, the Wait But Why, that guy says that no one person knows how to build a pencil. And like everything, you know, no one knows how to refine the graphite or to make the wood or the paint or the rubber individually, but we're a sum of all of our moving parts. And you get this huge appreciation for like, I don't know, like a hamburger. Like if you had to make a hamburger from scratch on a desert island, it would, you know, it'd probably take 100 years or whatever it may be to refine the corn and you know, get the cat, whatever it might be. But just going straight back to like layer zero, I think it's really good for changing the aperture and perspective of where we've come as a species, how fortunate we are. You come back with this renewed appreciation for running water and flat surfaces without sand and refrigeration and beds. And I think it's quite grounding for us to remember, you know, what we are, as, you know, as animals. And yeah, it just gives us a nice perspective. And it is something like primal that lights up in us when we make our first friction fire, for sure. Like that, it truly is like Tom Hanks demonstrated it in Castaway, like, fire! Something just within you that sets alight when you make your first ever fire, like, which is a massive technology unlock, and leads to like all these other paths that you can now go and achieve. And so, yeah, I think it just gives good perspective, and it's kind of empowering to an extent as well, I guess.
You know, a lot of the people that go on your trips, they say it's the hardest thing they've ever done in their life, according to your website, and That is a recipe in some ways for transformative travel, right? Like even on a lesser level, I feel that is some of my most memorable trips, or some of the lessons that still stick with me are from, you know, the times when you maybe were roughing it, and maybe that's not living on a desert island, you know, trying to survive, but you know, maybe really extreme budget travel, or, you know, you just don't have a lot of resources and you have to be resourceful, right? I think that's one of the key things. It's you're learning the skills to be resourceful. And when you self-identify as a resourceful person, I think it does open up a lot of possibilities in life, right? Like confidence, you can figure things out. And yeah, so I'm just wondering about these transformative travel experiences. You've seen them on the ground with some of your clients. What has that meant to them? And I'm curious about some of your, I mean, we already talked about a couple of yours, but if there was another one, maybe perhaps from your personal life that you wanted to share that maybe transformed the way you look at life.
I mean, I've definitely shared my big two crossroads, but to share some of my customers, like, again, we didn't set this up for transformational travel. It's just the idea is, you know, to be in nature, learn cool skills and have a lot of fun. But I think getting off that hamster wheel of life, looking around, people suddenly realize, I don't know, maybe I've been working a job for the last 15 years that doesn't fulfill me, that I'm not happy with, or my partner's not doing it for me. They, you know, you've never stopped and look around and got off that hamster wheel. And we've had people leave their partners, and we've had people leave their jobs. I've had people lose like 30% of their, we've had obese people who are now marathon runners. We've had big quite seismic changes, and I don't position it as a transformational travel experience, and I don't really want to attract people who are maybe in the midst of a midlife crisis too much, but it is beneficial for people, partly through the adversity and partly just through slowing down, I think, and being in nature like that. I should probably kind of share the format, because I feel like you mentioned how hard it was, and so the whole point is that we create an experience that is maybe more accessible. Most people maybe don't think to go and do survival and bushcraft, but then when it's paired up with being on a beautiful desert island, they think, ah, oh, I could do that. and it kind of, it does in a way make it more accessible, because anytime it gets too much, you just jump into that turquoise ocean and you've got this reset and you're like, oh, you know, everything is fine. If you're like a bit too hot or whatever. But the way we do it is that it's aimed at people that have never done anything like this before. And the first 5 days on the island are that kind of survival light where we're building up people's skill sets and their confidence. And so they're sleeping in expedition hammocks with built-in mosquito nets. We're cooking together as a tribe. We bring in food, you know, like we're making big pasta meals and Thai curries cooked in bamboo. And it's, you know, you're eating well and you're sleeping well and you're having some rum around the fire and playing games in the evening whilst you're learning all these cool skills. So we, you know, each day we're teaching them how to build shelter, how to, you know, weave palms and make natural cordage and ropes and stuff, how to make fire by friction, how to catch fish, how to identify wild edibles, how to turn seawater and freshwater, yada, yada, yada. But whilst you're doing that, whilst you're learning this stuff, we want you to be able to absorb it, to not be just broken and exhausted. So for 5 days, it's kind of like a, you know, we're a tribe and we're all mucking in, and it's my favorite part of the trip by far. And people do say it is their favorite part of the trip. But after those 5 days, that's when shit gets real, and we take away, they don't have their hammocks anymore. They basically just have a machete, a hand knife, a sat phone, a medikit, a handful of fish hooks, and if we're feeling kind, a little bag of flour that they can make ash cakes with on the fire. And then they go to a new part of the island, and they've got 3 days to survive. So they've got to get that fire by friction. You know, they don't even have a headlight, so they live by the moon. And they, you know, they go back to their circadian rhythm of waking up and at sunrise and going to bed just after sunset. And they've got to catch their fish. They're responsible for their own survival at that point. So those 3 days, kind of time extends, and it feels more like a week for them. But that's when the learning happens. That's when they go in on themselves. And that's, yeah, I guess that's where the hard work internally is done. And then the speedboat arrives over the horizon, laden with cold beers and fruits and rescued. And we go back to the hotel that now feels like a 10-star hotel. And we go out and eat our waiting pizza. And yeah, that's kind of the experience in a nutshell.
That must be one of the best beers you ever have.
8 a.m. beers. It feels so right.
Are there some sort of policies for if somebody really gets in trouble? Have you had any incidents where like people can't make it on their own and then you need to help them out type of thing?
Yeah, so we've had a couple of evacuations for minor things, a fish hook through the finger and a machete through the finger or through the tendon. It was yours truly, by the way. I was running the trip solo right at the beginning of the third ever trip for a group of Danish entrepreneurs. So we obviously have an evacuation strategy, and all of our instructors are qualified in wilderness first aid with Knowles. And so, yeah, we go through that and we practice that. But it sounds extreme, but the nice thing about islands is they're pretty easy to evacuate from. It's not like being in the mountains or in the jungle. And generally, the dangers aren't too severe. Machetes, which are something you can pretty much keep control of, and just, you know, slipping on rocks is probably my biggest concern.
Mm. It's such a cool format that you've created here, and that's what it is, right? I mean, you have to create the box within to have the experience, right?
Yeah, I think it's important to, like, I don't want it to feel contrived in any way. I want it to feel like raw adventure, and it is raw adventure, but with that that safety net is still there, that framework is there, but far enough away that it doesn't feel like it is too much there, if that makes sense. Like, it has to remain adventurous. Injury has to be possible. Adversity, you know, you're going to have adversity, you're going to have challenge, but if the shit really hits the fan, you know, we've got you.
Mm. The digital detox aspect, do you get any feedback from that?
People, again, it's really nice how when you sit around the fire and talk, and even like people who've never met, so normally it's 10 strangers, basically. Unless it's a private group trip, it's people that don't know each other. And it's amazing how within just like 24, 48 hours, people bond deep, people share a lot. And I don't know if it's about that kind of low light or just the environment, but it really brings out the best in people. We're not looking at our phones. We're there, we're attentive, and we, you know, you really engage with people. I think that's really healthy. That's really nice. When people get back off the island, they're really, rather than like desperate to check their phones, they're like, I'm just going to put it off for a few more hours. and really enjoying that disconnect from the whole world. And it is, and you know, nothing necessarily, okay, we had COVID happen once and so the world did change and when people got off the island, but generally speaking, you know, we don't need to be so hyper connected, and it's fairly unnatural state for us, and it feels good not to be so connected.
Yeah, let's talk about destinations. You've traveled a lot, and you have also found these islands with your unique qualifications, which may be no small feat considering how developed the world is. So yeah, I'd love to share a little bit more about where you guys go, and then I just want to hear a bit more about destinations from your personal travels.
Yeah, so we run our expeditions at the moment in Panama, the Philippines in Palawan, and in Tonga in the South Pacific, not too far from Fiji. And yeah, the criteria for like a desert island that works for us is it's finding this kind of Goldilocks zone of not too hot, not too cold with tourism. So it has to be close enough to tourism that we've got that infrastructure in place where you've got the hospital in case of emergency, you've got the hotel that we start and finish from, and the transport links that make it possible rather than going like deep into Sulawesi or something and it taking 70 hours of travel to get there. So that has to be there, but it can't be too hot. It can't be too close to tourism that you've got, you know, lights on the horizon and tourists turning up and boats. And so it's really hard because that sphere of tourism is growing all the time. And I guess we're going to have our islands consumed. Like right now, the island in Panama is up for sale for $11 million. I'm thinking about crowdfunding 2,000 NFTs to all of us allowed to save that island if anyone's interested.
Really?
In that. Yeah, I think like I want to preserve these wildernesses, and I feel like crowdfunding to protect wilderness would be, an excellent way to go. But anyway, I'll try and keep back on track. There's going to be a hotel built on that, and we'll lose that island. So we always have to be looking over the horizon for that next viable island, which is a challenge. And then it also has to be safe. You know, we can't have any pit vipers and we can't have pirates, which is a problem in the south of the Philippines. It sounds like it's archaic, but it is an issue. And then it has to be beautiful, and then it has to not be infested by sandflies or mosquitoes, and then it has to have all the resources that we need, and it has to have and it's really hard, and I refuse to have it make any concessions on that like perfect formula of islands. So I need to get out there. I've got a few target islands that we're looking at the moment, but I guess it's half the fun. It's hunting.
Do you just mad research and then boots on the ground type of thing?
Yeah, I guess I kind of feel I'll give away my secrets a little bit, but so I find them sometimes through TV shows. So if the TV companies have done the due diligence for us, and we can out that Survivor or Naked and Afraid or Bear Grylls did it. So that's how we found the first island through Bear Grylls. And then I do a lot of like scouring on Google Earth, and you'll use clues like that island looks amazing, and then you can cross reference it with airports, and then you can look even at the wakes of boats, because the satellite imagery will show the wakes where the boats were, and you can get an idea for how populous it was and stuff like that and how busy that area is. So yeah, there's like, it's a pretty fun, I feel like a bomb villain almost.
I like to geek out on it, right?
Yeah, man, I love getting lost in Google Earth. So we're looking at we're looking at Northern Indonesia and Myanmar at the moment as well, but there's challenges with that. And then we're thinking about doing a Amazon island survival where we will spend 5 days kayaking down river, spending time with different tribes, and then survive on an island within the Amazon, which would be quite different, but good for people that have already been on our trips before to do something completely different.
It sounds like you got your plate pretty full with all the things going on.
Yeah, I know. That's why the whole surviving, saving the island piece is daunting, because that's a whole rabbit hole to open if we're going to try and buy these islands.
Yeah. We'll be back in a moment. Here's a quick powerful exercise. If you think about one or two of your big goals and then you fast forward a few months from now, what can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If one of those goals for you is learning a new language or even just a little bit of a language to enhance your next trip, you should absolutely get Babbel. They have quick 10-minute lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts. You can actually start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations, exactly what you want as a traveler. I just downloaded it and went into the Norwegian course area thinking, oh, I've got this. Immediately made a bunch of grammar mistakes that they corrected. And I was like, oh, I've been doing this wrong. So I'm already leveling up and learning. And you can get Babbel now. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/zerototravel. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/zerototravel, spelled BABBEL.com/zerototravel. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thank you to Babbel for supporting today's show. Hey, Jason here. Did you know we have a free weekly newsletter over at zerototravel.com/newsletter? I put my heart and soul into this newsletter and love keeping in touch with listeners off the podcast. That's where you can find out about all of the latest and greatest events, trips we're planning, and of course, you're going to get money-saving travel tips, destination advice, all kinds of stuff to provide value and help you add more travel into your life. So why not sign up? Again, totally free, no cost at all. zerototravel.com/newsletter. Excited to welcome you into that community. Thanks for listening. Now let's get back to the show. What about personal destinations that you visited that you've really enjoyed?
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know if you'd agree, but my perception of places changes with time. Like when you go somewhere when you're 20, 21, and you're wet behind the ears and you've never experienced travel, it just intoxicates you and overcomes you. So like the first time I walked around Bangkok when I was 19, or when I first went to an island in the Philippines when I was 21, I almost can't get those highs again. Like those will always be like my travel highlights, just because, you know, I'd never opened Pandora's box. And so I don't think I'll ever get that quite that same intense rush again. That I've still got so much beauty to see, so many different, I'd like to stick off another 70 or so countries in my life. But yeah, Southeast Asia really does it for me. I do love Thailand. I love the default kind nature of Thai people. I do adore the tropics. I think I'm happy to live in Lisbon and then go and scratch the itch of the tropics and then come back to the functionality of Lisbon. But I need that tropical hit for sure.
So how has the nomad thing been? How long have you got? Sounds like you're settling down now in a way. I guess I'm using air quotes. You're finding a place to live in one particular place. But you said you've been bumping around with your family. How has that experience been for you?
It's been cool. We were meant to move to Thailand. Like my wife left her job. We went to Thailand to go full-time desert island survival and find islands all across Southeast Asia. And then COVID hit. And so like then our plans dramatically changed. We didn't intend to be so nomadic. And then we've just kind of been hot stepping around. My son has probably had like 30, 40 different bedrooms and he knows no different. For him, it's just normal. And he seems to, like, you know, kids are so adaptive and he thinks it's great. And he can't believe that we're about to stay in the same place. He's like, but when, what, when are we not going to, why are we not going to move? And so, yeah, it's been cool. I think it's also a little exhausting. It's really hard to run a business and also be constantly planning the next month for the family. It's quite demanding mentally and on your resources as well. And with a kid, it's much easier without a child. But when you've got to get that piece of the puzzle of where will they, you know, get some education, get their education, or at least like glorified childminding, then that's tough. And you have to build around that. Otherwise, yeah. I think it was just the two of us. We, you know, just go anywhere beautiful with an Airbnb.
Right. What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned just from running the business? You can say business lessons as a digital nomad or a location independent entrepreneur, kind of on the move, but also doing all this stuff you're doing.
I should really rehearse and have these answers prepared, but I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Like one of the things I've kind of got to the conclusion of 90% is good enough. Like at the beginning, I had so much control over like the how things were written and the social media posts and stuff like that. And then I think it's so important to learn to relinquish that control, because if you try to control everything, you can't really scale. And so I've got to that point of, you know, 90% is good enough. Let's just do a bit more. When that comes to the social media and the CRM, when it comes to the islands and the actual experience, I will not make a concession. This last year hired the most amazing operations manager, if you will, Layla, who's just allowed me to really be able to focus on the areas that I'm passionate about and outsource all the pieces that I'm not interested in, that don't light me up. Kind of like education, you know, like I just can't be doing with any of the accounting aspects of it and the CRM automations and insurance pieces and stuff like that. So outsourcing to where my strengths don't lie. Otherwise, I find I have to work 4 or 5x the amount of time to do those elements that don't come so naturally to me. So that's been a big realization for me.
Yeah, that's huge, kind of bringing on somebody like that that can take a lot off your plate. And that's always one of the conundrums, I think, of the solopreneur, if you want to call it, when you're starting out, you're just kind of doing everything on your own. At what point do you kind of take the chance and invest in somebody, and then you hope you find the right person? And yeah, there's a lot to it.
Well, and it is that realization that we're like, I'm one crank or one cog, and a business can only function by like having multiple cogs, and you can only do one revolution yourself, if that makes sense, but you need to have these multiple cogs out there to turn a bigger wheel. And you can't, you know, you just can't simply scale generally unless you do start to find the right people and rely on other people.
Yeah. What is the biggest lesson you've learned personally from just starting this and building it to where it's at now?
Don't doubt yourself too much and go for it. But it's cliche. And then I also worry, like, you know, they say follow your dreams. And like my friend Sam, he's just packed up his job, spent £70,000 to become a pilot, only for COVID to hit and for him to not be able to become a pilot. And so like you hear, I almost think of myself as like, you know, one of the people that won the lottery, but you don't hear of the 99 people that don't. So I'm reluctant to say like, follow your dreams, it'll work out. But, and it also cliche, like if you love what you do, you never work another day in your life. And it is true. Like if you're just working things you're passionate on, it doesn't really matter if it's not making money initially. Like I have friends who takes people out fishing in Panama, and now it's an Airbnb experience, and suddenly it's taking up more and more of his time because he does it because he loves it. So yeah, finding those things that really light you up and enjoy them, and just putting extra time into it and seeing if it is something that can actually scale into something. I think the internet has given us the opportunity for niches to thrive, from someone having their store on Etsy that can become really popular to someone doing like fishing trips in the Panamanian jungle and actually make it into a business. You can always find those experts now, and potentially build businesses on. If you're in the top 1,000 people for a small niche, then you can build a business on that.
Yeah. That's great advice. Thanks. I hear you on the sort of the follow your dreams thing. It's there's no guarantee of success, right? But I think a good way to kind of think about it is, okay, well, if I do follow this dream or pursue this thing, well, I mean, it's going to lead to something, whether it's that thing or the next thing or whatever. And if you're sort of at peace with like, okay, well, I'm just going to go on this journey, and even if it doesn't work out, this is an experience I'm excited to have, and I'll trust that it's going to lead somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Because that's a muscle in and of itself, I feel like, just like giving yourself permission to kind of start something and follow a dream in that way is another muscle that you build that allows you to kind of give you the confidence to just like keep doing that in life.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And you said trust as well. It made me think of another aspect that I like to apply to business is just always starting from a position of trust with people, because business is often working and building partnerships with other people. And I just read Humankind, which talks about human kindness, and just like having that default position that generally most people are lovely, excellent people, and starting from a position of 100% trust, only to have that trust eroded if you are burnt. But you know, I think it just leaves all the doors open to opportunities. And I always just go into positions not being naive, but just believing in people and believing in opportunities working out, not always looking over my shoulder thinking, oh, this person's trying to steal this from me or whatever it might be. But I don't know how much that applies to other businesses. But I think, default trust in people is a nice place to start from.
Humankind, that was a book recommendation then?
Yeah, it's a lovely book. If you enjoyed, say, like Sapiens, it's a nice follow-on from that. It's by a Dutch guy called, quickly Googling it, Rutger Bregman. It's a lovely, lovely book. But it also touches on, like, I'm fascinated about our pre-programming and how things change with the dawn of agriculture. And it looks a lot at that and the kind of the social structures that we had as tribes and what was rewarded. Like generally, like we've moved, we are now homo puppy. We've become more and more soft and kind and gentle because these were things that within the tribe were actually celebrated within leaders. You know, if you were covetous and if you, this is before the dawn of agriculture where everything changed, but if you were selfish or covetous and stuff, you know, your tribe turned on you and blew 100 poison darts into your back if you're an asshole. But if and so we've actually kind of our evolution has been towards kindness and goodness, and it's only really and we didn't have ownership of property until the dawn of agriculture when we suddenly had food resources and we had to build power structures and armies and such. Anyway, I go on a tangent, but it's a lovely book, and if anyone doesn't have a default belief in humanity, then it really helps to change that lens and think better of us.
This is a kind of an interesting aspect of your work that I hadn't thought about, because you are, you know, going through the tribe lens, right? Which kind of extrapolating that out and looking where we're at as a society today, you can't help but reflect on the institutions and kind of how it's evolved, right? Because you are offering people an experience that's taking them back to their base primal needs and just the way it was. And that's, those two worlds are dramatically different.
Yeah. It's magnificent what we've achieved, but I think no one really seems to remember that only 10,000 years ago, there was just 5 to 10 million of us. And that was, you know, we were just a large mammal that was hunter gathering, a set amount of resources, but only 5 to 10 million of us. And then we've exploded to 8 billion. And people always, like, on the island, like, yeah, where can I get carbohydrates and stuff like that? Like, we've only got 15 or so species really that give us 80% of all of our food, like carbohydrates. Like, we've cultivated grasses for wheat and barley and such, and potatoes and rice and sago palm in Africa. And, you know, these things are rare in nature, and everything that you see in the supermarkets is a kind of a genetically enhanced version of what it originally was in nature. You know, your bananas were full of seeds and your pineapples were smaller than your fist. And so, yeah, helping with that perspective of how far we've come. And also, you know, like it used to be a walk on the back of the salmon across to France from England. And hard to imagine what our planet was like 10,000 years ago from a resource perspective. And now practicing primitive skills in this kind of new world, like we were recently trying to use gorge hooks where you make a little hook out of bone and make the cordage out of hibiscus bark. And it's so hard because you've probably got like 1/100th of the fish available to you that the ocean would have had back then when we could apply these skills. We still have people like nail a stingray with a spike and stuff. It's a vastly different world to when these primitive skills were the, you know, the peak of technology.
Yeah. Has this changed your diet, your personal diet, just being on these trips? And
I should be better with that. And I haven't really, no. We have a lot of people who are very mindful of their diet, and we cater for vegetarians and vegans and help to supplement their diet so they can do these trips. But most become island pescatarian when they join us. Yeah,
right. Any other books you recommend? Because book recommendations are always nice. You mentioned the one.
Again, I wish I was better read. Like, Sapiens, I was saying, obviously, but I imagine a lot of people recommend that. I really like a lot of Bill Bryson. I think Bill Bryson Home is a really underrated book. Where he, I don't know if you read it, he goes like from room to room and just talks about every item in there and goes on like a beautiful journey on the kind of the etymology of it. So like, I don't know, not considering the table didn't used to have legs and it was a board, and you get your board and lodging and stay somewhere, and they give you a board with your food on, and to be trustworthy was to have your hands above board. And like, it just goes down all these beautiful little rabbit holes about everything that you don't really consider, like why we have salt and pepper as the two primary kind of condiments that sit on our table. And yeah, you learn a lot, and it's fun.
I'm a Bill Bryson fan, and I The Body was another one, and he has the book about
everything.
Yes, which is incredible, and his travel books and everything. So cool. But I haven't read that one, so I'll have to take a look at that.
And then, like, I guess I should do a survival one. I'm trying to remember the exact name. It's like 432 days, but it's not. It's a sea survival story of this Mexican fisherman who gets swept away off the coast of Mexico, and it's the longest ever sea survival, and he survives for 432 days, more or less, so like a year and a half, just out in a small little fiberglass hull. He uses a cool box for his shade. He catches birds by night and just hides in this cool box for a year and a half throughout the sunny days, collects water bottles that he fills with fresh water when it rains. It's just one of the most shockingly challenging endurances of survival. I really enjoyed it and often reference it on the island.
Wow. Well, congratulations, man. We should mention the URL again. It's desertislandsurvival.com, and we'll drop that in the show notes. Anything else you want to add, Tom?
Not really. My Twitter is Desert Island Tom. I'm also a crypto guy on there. I do like a crypto channel because I had to see myself through the COVID winter. So I've been involved in that. But it's kind of strange, and I struggled with having those two worlds because it's such a dichotomy from this purest pursuit of survival. But I kind of now like the yin and the yang. I can live with it. So if anyone's in Lisbon wants to get a coffee or a beer, let me know. I'm going to be here for a while now, and always open to meet new people.
I'm just inspired by your story and that you were able to create this company that, yeah, feeds your passions and also gives people a chance to have such a unique experience in a world where this type of experience is hard. It's kind of hard to come by. I think that's why it's blowing up for you. So just congrats on all that. Hope we can stay in touch. And yeah, I'll take you up on that coffee/beer Lisbon thing. Just appreciate your time today, man. Thanks so much for coming on, and hope to stay in touch.
Oh, thank you, Jason. That's really, really kind of you. It's been lovely chatting with you, and I look forward to meeting IRL in real life.
Sounds good. Cheers.
Take care, man.
There you have it. I want to thank Tom for stopping by the show. Of course, desertislandsurvival.com is the website. And if you want to get back to your primal instincts, back to the basics, you can go on there and see what trips they have coming up. Looks like they're all full right now, but you can always hop on the email list. And speaking of that, if you haven't been on the ZeroToTravel.com email list and you want to keep in touch off the podcast, please take a moment to sign up and keep in touch. Would love to have this be a two-way conversation. I'm always begging for listeners to get in touch because I love to hear from you and I love the community aspect of this podcast. It's what's kept me going for almost 9 years now, which is insane. Now, quickly, I teased out at the beginning this lesson I just read from a Grammy Award-winning artist, Jack White. You might have heard of him from the White Stripes, and of course, he has his own solo stuff. I read an article with him in a magazine I subscribe to called American Songwriter, and I've heard this about him before, too. He's talked about this in other interviews. What he does often, I think all the time, as part of his creative process, is he makes things harder on himself. He actually tries to mess things up. So there is some kind of struggle. He does this famously with some of his guitars by using guitars that are cheap and go out of tune really easy. A couple of the examples that he used in the article. One thing he said when he was recording two albums in the same year with a couple bands, he used only one microphone for these albums on every single instrument, which really makes things difficult. And another example he used, if he was playing bass on a song, instead of picking up the brand new bass in the studio that would be really easy for him to play, he would take this old fretless bass that didn't have any frets on it. So if you don't know what frets are, they're the lines on the guitar that kind of tell you where the notes are. They're a reference point for the notes. But if you don't have any frets, like you don't in a stand-up bass, for example, you have to just be able to play it by ear and know where the notes are. And he didn't have any experience playing a fretless bass, but he took that one anyway. So he does all these things to kind of screw things up. And I wanted to share a quote at the end where he says, I think not being satisfied is a good place to be. It's being very minimal on patting yourself on the back and stroking the ego and being more interested in going into new territory and being in a dangerous place. Being right on the edge of something that is not comfortable and trying to fight your way out of that box is a good spot to always remain in. You never win, you never conquer, you never actually get to the top of the mountain. End quote. And he fully admits that this is not something he's telling other artists to do. This is just him sharing his process. But for me, I really admire that. I really love that somebody that's so established that could just be doing the easy thing is finding all of these ways to challenge himself. And it was just a reminder for me that I wanted to share with you. It just got me thinking and asking myself this question, hey, what could I do to challenge myself in my work or in my life today? What are some simple things I could do to make it harder? I mean, one thing I could do, I just thought of this, is try to record this whole podcast in one take. Oftentimes when I do these intro and outro pieces, well, I have to stop and start sometimes because I lose my train of thought or I make a point and I realize I could have made it better. So I have to stop and make the point again, or maybe I'm too long-winded. Maybe I'm doing that right now. And I want to cut things short. And I do that for you, the listener. I want to make each show the best show it possibly can be. But when you know, make hundreds of shows and you have varying opinions from listeners out there, it's not always going to hit in every way, every moment. And I get that. But how can I level up my craft in podcasting or songwriting or whatever the things I'm doing personally with my own creative life and perhaps my own travel life? And I wanted to bring this up because I think it really ties in well with the conversation with Tom today. I mean, what is getting stranded on a desert island if not getting out of your comfort zone completely travel-wise? So how can we do that in our day-to-day lives? How can we get ourselves out of our own comfort zones and push and, you know, like Jack said, really kind of being in this place where we're not patting ourselves on the back too much. We're not stroking our egos. We're just getting into new territories, perhaps in these, what he said, dangerous places, putting ourselves in these situations and just kind of seeing what happens, right? And kind of pushing through. And it just got me thinking, how can I do this in my own life, in my travel life, in the things I'm planning? I don't know. Just something to think about. I wanted to share with you. And we all know that getting out of our comfort zone is good for us, but it doesn't mean we do it all the time because it's hard, right? Why do we want to make things harder on ourselves? It's annoying. It takes more time. It's uncomfortable. Yet we know that getting uncomfortable is good for us. It's kind of like, we know the salad's good for us, but we can't always eat the salad. Sometimes we want the mashed potatoes. I don't know. I didn't know I was going to talk about salads and mashed potatoes here at the end, but there you go. So anyway, some food for thought, maybe a little challenge for you, maybe a prompt for you to get in touch and let me know your thoughts. Give me your ideas too. Don't forget to reach out because I love to share them on the show. And as we get out of here, I am going to leave you with a quote from a very funny comedian, Stephen Wright. Not sure if you're familiar with his stuff. And he said, someone asked me, if I were stranded on a desert island, what book would I bring? How to Build a Boat. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.